play with us. Come play with us, Daddy.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Forever and ever and ever.
And that's what I like also about the book. You're not a card-carrying paranormal thumper, if you will. You're not out there saying it has to be paranormal. You acknowledge in the book that it could very well possibly be a creation of the witness. Something from, you know, maybe they're particularly down. Bad things are happening. Their life is in turmoil, and then all of a sudden they have this experience. Maybe it's a projection of the mind.
That's very possible, and it's something I examined quite a bit, because one of the few threads that I found to connect the victims was that there's a high number of people who encounter these kids who work in positions of authority. So, you know, there's a lot of accounts from police officers, military personnel, government employees, doctors. And, you know, those jobs very often are high stress, a lot of hours. Those are intense careers. And you have to question how that plays into these manifestations. You know, is that some result of the person's psyche? Now, it's kind of a two-edged sword, because at the same time, you know, sitting down and talking to a deputy sheriff and hearing his account, it's pretty mind-boggling, because this is someone who is a trained observer. Their very existence and you know, their very life depends on paying attention to things. So we end up with, you know, an account that we can put a lot more stock in and at the same time, you know, grab some extra details from that, you know, the average, you know, person out there is probably not going to notice.
Right. And it goes, you know, it bears mentioning, and I've had this conversation on the show about this sort of possibility that ghosts are a projection of the mind. You know, that's not necessarily some kind of, like, cop-out, just because if it turns out that that's the case, that's still pretty amazing and fantastic and bizarre and weird, you know, that the mind can create these little children with black eyes that show up at your house. So, you know, people should, if it turns out it's a creation of the mind, people shouldn't be disappointed. They should be, you know, even more intrigued, because what the hell else are we creating?
Right, and there is a basis for that in, you know, some traditions. I mean, I referenced the tulpa earlier,
right,
which is an ancient Tibetan concept. And, you know, in that, in the tulpa, we are talking about a being that is created from pure mental energy. Now, the ancient Tibetans had a very specific process that would need to be followed in order to create a tulpa, but its evolution would begin in the consciousness of the person creating it and extend out to, you know, this sort of etheric form that was very much like a ghost that eventually, as the process continued, would take on solid form. So, you know, it's very possible. I mean, I personally think that, you know, there are some hauntings that definitely are the result of so many people focusing their energy on a particular being. Now I get a little bit of grief for that, but you know, here's a good example. The Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana, one of the most famous haunted spots in the country. And, you know, thousands of people a year go there, you know, attempting to capture a ghost on film, or, you know, EVPs and so forth. One of the main ghosts they're looking for is of the slave Chloe. Now, ironically, there's no historical foundation for such a person ever existing. It appears to be a complete fabrication. It's an intriguing story, but that's sort of all it is. It's a good story. It's a good, you know, it's good folklore, and it makes for great, you know, great material on the ghost tour when you go there. But, you know, the fact of the matter is these children, for instance, that were supposedly poisoned by Chloe, historical records show that they died of, I believe it was yellow fever.
Huh.
So, you know, it's very intriguing when we look at the historical facts, and then we counter that with people going there and capturing evidence that appears to point to a being named Chloe. There's a very famous photograph that was taken. To my knowledge, it has not been debunked. It shows a woman who fits the description of Chloe with a turban on her head and, you know, period attire, standing between the main plantation house and the secondary building. And it's a fascinating photograph, but, you know, why was that captured when there was no historical person named Chloe serving at that plantation? Well, if you've got thousands of people over, you know, how many years going there and focusing energy on the idea of Chloe, what do you get?
You get Chloe.
You get Chloe. You know, one of my favorite, Kate, one of my big inspirations was John Keel. You know, I love his material, love his approach. And, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting him a number of times. There's a John Keel followed up on a case. He was called to a house in Greenwich Village, and the people were having issues. They thought the house was haunted. Now, it turns out this house was owned by the creator of The Shadow.
Oh, wow.
He wrote under the pen name Maxwell Grand. His real name was Walter Gibson. And at his peak, this man wrote two novels a month.
Oh, wow.
About The Shadow, along with other material that he was writing. So he was incredibly prolific. I mean, as a writer, that's just mind-boggling to me that someone could write, you know, a complete novel every 2 weeks, essentially. So that is an intense amount of creative energy focused into, you know, his creation, The Shadow. And the people who were now living in his home reported a ghostly figure that was showing up in their home wearing a large slouched hat and a flowing cape. I mean, it fit the description of The Shadow. Their house was haunted by The Shadow.
That's crazy. That is strange. Wow. Well, it just goes to show you that this world's stranger than we could even imagine. Now, at the risk of upsetting the listener who wrote, I mean, the reader who wrote to you, saying they were convinced that these were hybrids, I'm almost convinced, having read the book now, I'm willing to really lower the probability that these things are aliens down to a very low, low probability, in my mind, at least. Because it just doesn't seem to add up that they'd be aliens. Aliens,
right.
they don't seem to care very much about whether you give them permission or not to do anything. So that's kind of one aspect of it. And, you know, they don't seem... The agenda of the Black Eyed Kid seems to be wholly different from what I would expect the agenda from the aliens to be. And I know I'm speaking in very broad terms about a lot of speculative things, but that's been all of America, so what do you expect, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, personally, I don't believe that they're hybrids either. I can tell you that that is probably the most popular theory to explain these things.
Really?
Now, a lot of that is because people simply look at the image and say, oh, it's got to be an alien hybrid because of the eyes. You know, it's a very startling similarity. You know, if you look at the image of these black-eyed kids and you compare it, say, to, you know, the cover of Communion, for instance, which gave us that iconic image of the gray aliens, it's very interesting and intriguing, but I don't think that it explains these children at all. Now, you know, a lot of the people that argue that are people who claim they have been abducted and used for, you know, some type of breeding program and actually have memories and accounts, whether they were, you know, retrieved in dreams or via hypnosis and so forth, of seeing their hybrid children, and they often are described in a similar fashion as being, you know, very pale skinned with the large black eyes like the gray aliens are depicted as having. I'm not convinced that's what's going on here. I really am not. And, you know, I have some slightly different opinions on the whole UFO phenomena anyway. So,
Now, I'm intrigued. What are these opinions?
Well, I'm not a big supporter of the, you know, the hard science mechanical ships coming down from some other planet landing here. You know, I think that we're looking at visitation possibly from something, again, that's other dimensional, as opposed to, you know, hard science UFOs landing here.
Right, like a straight up, they're astronauts from another world.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, that being said, I do lean towards the idea that the planet probably was visited in our ancient history by extraterrestrials, because there's so much intriguing evidence that kind of points to that. But in modern times, I'm just not convinced that that's what's going on currently. You know, there's obviously a lot of people on a regular basis having very strange encounters with beings that we simply can't explain away. And I think there are far too many of those cases to simply discard it all, and say that it's nonsense. But I think we're a long way from understanding really what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, with the, how I've discounted the alien part of it, this doesn't seem, let's pull the camera back a little bit. Okay. So they're making these hybrid alien human kids. Then they're just going to leave them at some neighborhood to try and get into a house. Why? You know, to further, like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it really doesn't add up. It really doesn't. You know, the one intriguing story that kind of falls into that category that's in the book was a woman who had one of these black-eyed kids show up at the, you know, the back door of her home. And, you know, she swears that it is her child, her hybrid child, as a result of her abductions. And it kind of falls into the black-eyed kid scenario in some ways, except that this woman did not have that reaction of fear when she encountered this kid. You know, she was sort of overwhelmed emotionally, but it wasn't from being terrified. And the only accounts really that I've heard of people encountering these kids who were not totally frightened in the situation have been people that believe that they're hybrid children. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how that all fits in. It's intriguing, but it, you know, for me personally, it doesn't add up to me that that's what's going on here.
Hmm. It makes you wonder if the, for quote unquote aliens are interdimensional and they are creating the hybrids, maybe they're trying to create some sort of bridge species that can be between the two worlds.
Yeah, it's possible. That's possible. You know, it just seems like these kids, when they show up, have some totally separate agenda, as you mentioned, from anything that is alien related. And, you know, one of the goals to me appears to be creating this intense level of fear within people, because it's inevitable that once the victim reaches that peak of fear, these things disappear. They're just gone.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you, I think you make the point in the book. Yeah. That maybe we're being thrown off by the need for the invitation. Maybe that's just sort of like a, you know, like the magician trick, you know, that's the red herring of the whole story. And actually just the whole creeping the person out is the real agenda.
It could be, because, you know, the invitation, it does add the creepy factor in, you know, and it makes people question exactly what's going on. Now, the other thing that people report in these encounters, there are a lot of people who say that they feel like some type of mind control or hypnosis is being attempted as these children are speaking. And, you know, one of the intriguing witnesses I had was a woman who had used hypnotherapy herself to stop smoking. And when she went through the process, initially she had a difficult time going into trance, so to speak. So she had to work with her therapist a little bit, and as a result, she developed a very distinct feeling that meant she was going under, essentially. Hmm. So when she encountered these black-eyed children, she said as they were talking in their monotone voice, and repeating these phrases over and over again, she said that she started to have that sensation. And, you know, it was a warning sign for her, because it immediately was like, why would I be, you know, going into a hypnotic state? And it caused her to get away from them. But she was convinced that something about these kids, that they were attempting to exert hypnosis on her.
It's certainly, yeah. Well, like I said, when I was sort of laying out the textbook cases, that seems to be the overwhelming, there's mental interference. There's definitely some kind of mental interference going on during these encounters.
Absolutely. And there's a psychological aspect too, Tim, because you got to understand that, you know, people always ask me, do you think these things are really children? And my answer is no, I don't. And, you know, the follow-up question is always, well, why are they appearing as children? Well, what better way to catch an adult off guard? Hmm. And what I see in the people who encounter these things is that they've gone through this psychological battle because, you know, as an adult, most of us are hardwired to help children. You know, if a child approaches you and says, Mr., I need help, you're probably going to do whatever you can. So, you know, what you see in these encounters is that people really struggle between the innate desire to help this child that is asking for something, you know, whether they're asking to come in or asking to use the phone or whatever it is they're asking for, you know, the desire is there to help this kid, but there's some overwhelming feeling that these people experience physically and emotionally that causes them to struggle. You know, they're frightened of helping these children. So, you know, more than one person has reported to me that they, you know, they feel their hand on the door and they realize that, you know, somehow they've opened the door part way. And they're just thinking, well, you know, they're just kids. I need to help them. And so there's this real confusion that happens within the victims. And at the same time, counter to that, these same people will tell you that they felt like they were being eyed by a predator. That's a phrase I've heard more than once regarding people confronting these kids. So this whole battle ensues until something causes the person to sort of snap out of it and get away from these kids. That flight response kicks in and they're able to slam the door or drive away or somehow, you know, back away from these children.
Yeah. I find it interesting over the course of the conversation here, I've called them witnesses and experiencers, but you've called them victims. What makes you sort of choose that word?
The reason I choose that word is because after interviewing so many of these people, they're essentially, they come off like trauma victims.
Okay.
You know, they have this very unsettled nature about them. A lot of these people end up, you know, seeking some type of therapy. They go through things such as very disrupted sleep patterns. These people often can't return to the location where it's happened. You know, if it's happened at their home, they have a difficult time when people come to the door, even if they use the doorbell. You know, just the idea that someone's at the door is a bit unnerving for a lot of these people. So it really haunts the people who have encountered these things. And, you know, I think that victim is a more appropriate term because these people, they're just, you know, it's not like witnessing a UFO or sighting a Sasquatch or something like that.
Right.
They are very traumatized by the experience.
Okay, yeah, that wasn't a judgment call on my part. I was sort of...
Oh, yeah, I didn't think it was. I was just explaining... That aspect of it, because we hadn't covered that.
Right, exactly, yeah, because it kept striking me, and I wanted to know more about, clearly you know more about these things than I do, so you fleshed it out a little bit there, yeah. It's one of those weird things. It's like, part of me wishes it would happen just to experience it, and the other part of me is like, no, you don't want that to happen at all, dude.
Well, listen, Tim, if it happens, let them in and then report back to me.
I told you, I won't let them in. I'll try to take a picture of one, not like it's worth anything, but with my luck, I'd like hit him with a bat and it would turn out that it really was someone with a medical condition.
Right.
So then I'd be like the guy in the news who, you know, who slapped the kid on the airplane, you know. I'd be like, why did you hit that poor handicapped kid with the bat? I mean, it was a black-eyed kid, I thought.
Don't do that because, you know, then the media will jump all over all the paranormal people, so.
Yeah. They're always looking for some reason. Now, you say that these people are kind of haunted by this incident, and I mentioned earlier there was the one story about the lady who seemed to be followed by them, but that doesn't seem to be a recurring thing. It's not like abductions, which allegedly, you know, keep happening over and over again, same person. This is like, once the person has the one black-eyed kid encounter, they don't seem to come back for the most part.
For the most part, that's true. Now, you know, what does happen on occasion is that a lot of these people are convinced that the kids are going to come back. And, you know, there are a number of cases wherein the person has had the encounter, and even weeks later, you know, they'll have experiences such as, you know, there's one woman who was consistently waking up in the middle of the night. And she's a person who had had her encounter in the middle of the night. So she kept waking up at the same time that the encounter had happened. And in that sort of between state of being asleep and waking up, she was convinced that she, you know, heard tapping on her bedroom window or heard knocking at the door. You know, she would wake up very startled, convinced that the children had returned. But for the most part, you know, beyond that sort of lingering trauma, no, these people really, they don't have repeat encounters. You know, the one or two people that have had repeat incidents, it's been a situation where they've had an encounter with the kids, and then they're convinced that they later see them, you know, that the kids are watching them from across the street and things like that. But that's pretty rare.
Yeah. It's odd. This is such an incredibly difficult subject to really study in a way, too. You really can only go on the witnesses' experiences. As far as I can, you know, what other avenues really can you explore unless you, you know, rip their hair out or something to get a DNA sample or something?
It is. It's very confounding in that sense because, you know, there's not any evidence to examine. you know, there's not really any photograph. Photographs would sort of be irrelevant anyway.
Right.
You know, there's just really not much to get a hold of within this phenomena. You know, the best we can do is continue to look at the accounts and, you know, look for patterns within those. And, you know, of course, study it in, through the lens of other types of phenomena because, again, one of the intriguing and puzzling things about this is that they do share traits with so many different, types of paranormal manifestation.
Yeah, you wonder. You really just you're just left flummoxed again by what is at the root of all this. So, and the annoying part too is, it's like the witnesses or the victims they talk to these things, but they never give any answers that are worthwhile. Right? We never actually get anyone to get any of these kids to open up.
No.
And reveal more about, you know, what
no.
will happen if you let them in.
Yeah, it's always, you know, just back to the same point. You know, and there's other, you know, we can look at all the different factors. Now, you know, people always tend to ask, you know, well, do they ever show up? Are there any of these kids that are ethnic, you know, a different ethnicity? And there's not, you know, they're almost always just pale, pasty, white-skinned. Occasionally, we will hear accounts where the person says they have sort of an olive-toned skin. And curious enough, that sort of relates back to the Men in Black again, because those are the two things we hear in Men in Black accounts, you know, that they're either white or they look like they're possibly Mediterranean descent. And, you know, those are the only variations we seem to see in these kids. And, you know, as I said earlier, every time you think you've sort of heard it all within this phenomena, that they're all just sort of standard encounters, you'll hear something else that's really bizarre.
Right.
It fits the model, but has different aspects and sort of makes us shake our heads. You know, one of the ones that really got me was the guy, government employee in London, who came home. You know, he lived in a secure flat. He needed a key to get into the building. And he goes upstairs, second floor, goes into his flat. And he's inside, and he hears what he described as this weird thumping noise in the hallway. And this happens a second time. He's intrigued enough that he goes and opens his door and hears a pair of these black-eyed kids. And you know, he's someone who has lived in different places around the world, and as he described it to me, they were doing a poor imitation of a British accent. So he thought that they were just some kind of street kids or something, you know, something some kind of nonsense going on. He wondered how they got in the building. You know, he's asking them where their parents are. You know, he's looking up and down the hallway. And they're saying things like, to him, like, well, we just want to watch the telly. And he's thinking, you know, what are you kids doing in here? You know, where are your parents? And he's having that reaction where he realizes that he's kind of opened the door a little bit and not even consciously aware of it. He glances into his apartment because he's getting a little bit freaked out, and he's thinking, is there something I can grab to defend myself? Because he's now wondering, you know, exactly what's going on here. Just in those few seconds it takes him to turn his head, glance into his flat, and look back, there's now three of these kids. They've multiplied.
Bizarre.
And, you know, that was kind of enough for him. He sort of, you know, he's really, really freaked out now, and he slams the door on him, and he's, you know, realizes once he's inside how shaken up he is, and he's kind of walking around. He goes to call his neighbor or something, and he hears this weird thumping noise out in the hallway again. And he sort of gets his nerve up because when he cracks the door open a little bit and he looks around, he doesn't see these kids. He opens the door and they're completely gone. Now, you know, he later told me that he's convinced that that noise, that weird noise he heard, was the sound of them coming and going.
Hmm.
Which, you know, is sort of intriguing.
Right, right. That sort of ties into the, we don't necessarily know how these dimensional situations work, but like it
right.
ties into some potential, it's like their door opening and closing.
It could be, but you know, there's way too many of these cases where these kids, they just suddenly are gone.
Hmm.
And, you know, when you've got someone who is very aware and there's just nowhere these kids could have gone, I mean, that's kind of, that leaves you scratching your head, too.
Part of me thinks you invite them in. This is a theoretical thing. Part of me thinks that, you know, maybe if you invite them in, they just come in, disappear, and then your life goes to hell. Like, maybe we'll hear stories from people that that's happened, you know, that they never wanted to admit. All of a sudden they lost their job, you know, all this terrible stuff happened to them, you know, and they can trace it back to that, but they're not going to tell anybody that ever since they had this incident, it happened.
Well,
so maybe, you know,
there's another intriguing possibility here that I really haven't talked about a whole lot, and that's that the woman I referenced earlier who contacted me because she was having weird electronic things happen within her house while reading the book has the months have kind of rolled on, she started having what she thought were memories of encountering black-eyed children. And on her own, she went and had a session of regression done.
Hmm.
And using hypnosis, retrieved what she believes are memories of encountering these things. So, you know, we sort of get into a field where we have to wonder if some of the people who have encountered these things have repressed the memories or something has caused the memories to be erased from their conscious mind somehow, because I've had a few people contact me since the book has come out who don't have conscious memory of encountering the children but are convinced that they did and that they just can't completely get a hold of what happened or, you know, when it happened.
Hmm. Weird.
That's weird and, again, a bit disturbing, too.
The whole thing is disturbing,
yeah.
Dave. This is really...
But, like, you know, we kind of get into alien territory there again, too, because there's a lot of people that, you know, later believe, you know, that they recover abduction memories and so forth.
Right, and I think you touched on something that bears fleshing out in a way. You said people ask you if you think these are really children, and you say no. I'm in agreement there. I think that these are some kind of... whatever. I think there's something beyond... that there's small children with black eyes. I think there has to be something, there's some kind of projection or shape-shifting or chameleon-like quality to them that there's really something probably behind the black-eyed kids.
Right.
That's how right. I feel, at least. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's what I believe, and that sort of gets into the, you know, the whole dimensional theory again for me, because I believe that they're coming through and taking that form in order to... catch people unawares,
yeah.
Because, you know, what better way to, you know, catch an adult off guard than to appear as, you know, a supposedly harmless child. Now, why the black eyes? You know, that could be argued a lot of different ways. And there's a lot of people, you know, I mentioned that the alien hybrid theory is the most popular. I can tell you that very close behind that, the next most popular theory is that they are some kind of demonic entity.
Right, right. That's kind of where I'd been for a while too, but, still kind of have a little bit of a foot in that camp, but yeah, talk about that. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's so many things they share in common with classical, demonology rules, for the lack of a better term. For instance, you know, a demon can't enter, whether it's a home or a person's physical body or anything else, without some type of invitation. You know, a lot of people who study demonology will also tell you that a demonic entity can't completely take human form, that something has to be distorted, you know, whether it's a distorted hand or foot or possibly the eyes. You know, these eyes being solid black could indicate some type of other being that can't completely take human form, and hence the difference. So it's intriguing. You know, they certainly seem to have a very sinister agenda. People are always asking, well, don't you think there's anything positive about these encounters? No, I really don't, because, you know, all indications are that these are very traumatic experiences for people. And, you know, at the same time, if we can stretch and say that there's anything at all positive that comes as a result, we can look at the fact that a large percentage of the people who have these encounters later turn to some type of spiritual pursuit. Whether that means they go back to the religion they were raised in or they seek out something new, it's kind of 50-50. But these people, they often say that they're looking for some type of comfort or something that they feel will give them security or protection if these children ever return again. Hmm. Now, you know, that's kind of intriguing, and it's also interesting to me in that if we look at this in religious terms, I have yet to hear of a priest or a rabbi or any type of spiritual figure encountering one of these kids.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of interesting, especially when we look at the fact that so many authority figures encounter them. You know, why are religious authority figures the exception? You know, is there something that prevents these children from approaching them or something, you know, do they have some type of protection that keeps these kids at bay? We just don't know.
Right. And it would be interesting to know if anyone during an encounter invoked religion to end it. Has anything like that ever occurred?
I always ask that and I've never heard that.
Okay.
No, it's intriguing that, you know, as I said, most of these people, a large percentage of these people turn to religion afterwards. And I find that in the people who have these encounters, I haven't really encountered anyone who practices a spiritual tradition actively. So, you know, you ask them their religion and you'll often get a response like, well, I was raised Catholic, you know, or, well, you know, my dad's a Buddhist and things like that, but they'll say that they don't really practice any type of religious system. So that's kind of intriguing too, you know, because apparently these are not people who are strongly spiritual at the time of the encounter.
Hmm. Well, you kind of mentioned that too in the book, that maybe these, we think of them as inherently evil, but maybe at the end of the day they're some kind of wake-up call, you know, that is fundamentally positive. Maybe there's a positive reason behind it that, you know, like put the fear of God into you kind of thing.
Right. It could be having a positive result. You know, it could be a negative experience that's having a positive result because, you know, God knows we need some wake-up calls on this planet right now.
And that's for sure.
You know, anything that's going to help people with that process, ultimately maybe it's a good thing. But, you know, I don't really promote the idea that's the goal of these beings. I think it just may be a result of an unfortunate encounter.
Mm, yeah. Since you've afforded us some extra time here, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you've been looking at the paranormal for 30 years, so, and clearly this topic only came along like in the last 15. So what other stuff have you focused on, you know, over the course of this research career?
I kind of go in cycles. You know, when I started out in the paranormal, first of all, when you use that term, you know, in the 70s, people know that they knew that you meant the whole spectrum of it, you know, from UFOs to cryptids to haunted sites and psychic phenomena and everything else. You know, it's become very politicized over the years with all the little organizations and groups being created that want to, you know, be exclusive and say, oh, well, we only look at UFOs. You know, if you're talking about Bigfoot, you're nuts. And, you know, that's kind of a pet peeve with me, because I think it's very important to look at all of that data. And, you know, over the years, a lot of things have been lost because these organizations are trying to be exclusive. Now, there's nothing wrong with specializing and saying, well, I really just want to study UFOs. But my gosh, you know, if you're collecting UFO accounts and someone comes to you and they give you a valid encounter with a UFO and they say, well, you know, there was also this Sasquatch. Well, you know, MUFON's going to pitch you away right away.
Exactly.
Say, well, we can't take this. You need to go to the BFRO or whatever. And you'll find the same thing over there. You know, if you mention a flying saucer, oh, you must be kooky. But, you know, it's fascinating to look at these areas that are sort of clusters of activity. And that's something that has really intrigued me over the years, these paranormal hotspots, where there's a high level of just, you know, the whole spectrum. You know, people are seeing UFOs and cryptids and a wide range of things. So we've got areas like the Uinta Basin in Utah. It's, you know, home of the infamous Skinwalker Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've done a lot of research up there. There's a wide range of strange phenomena in that region. And it's not just on the ranch. It's in that whole basin. There are other areas around the country and all over the world, in fact. One of the areas that really intrigues me in the last few years are the Superstition Mountains in Arizona.
I've never heard of those.
A very bizarre place. You know, it's probably best known for being the location of the Lost Dutchman's gold mine. But an incredible number of people go missing in this region. The native tribes in the area have a lot of stories associated with the Superstition Mountains. And, you know, I've always studied shamanic traditions throughout my life and, you know, have found that it blends together with investigating the paranormal very well, because tribal cultures take a different view of these things. You know, they don't automatically assume that it's you know, something rational or explainable. They accept a lot of this phenomena, and they have, you know, valid traditions that say, well, yeah, that's happening and here's why. So, you know, the Superstition Mountains, there's a whole tradition about a whole series of stories about this reptilian king who lives beneath the superstitions. And, you know, these reptilian beings have been sort of a hot topic in the last few years, and a lot of people reporting sightings and claiming to see them and so forth. So, you know, my approach is to look at a lot of this phenomena, particularly these areas that are high concentrations of phenomena, and at the same time, look at the traditions that surround that area and start correlating that with modern data.
Interesting. Interesting. You got to check out the Bridgewater Triangle. That's up by my neck of the woods.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know about the Bridgewater Triangle. That's exactly one of those types of areas. You know, just an incredible amount of phenomena has occurred within that region.
Yeah, these window zones. That's a topic that's intrigued me for a long time, too, trying to get to the bottom of those.
Yeah, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And, you know, there's a lot of things that indicate that some type of portals are present, you know, within these regions. You go back again to the native traditions, they'll talk about there being portals or doorways there, you know, on these pieces of land, and that things come and go through those portals.
It'd be interesting to see sort of them put together on a map to see if there's any connection that way somehow.
They're pretty widespread. I mean, they're, yeah. You know, if you start mapping them, I have mapped them out to an extent, and they're, you know, you can find them all over the world. And, you know, they seem to, over the last few years, be becoming more active, which, again, is very intriguing to me. when we look at traditions that say we're moving into a very different time on this planet. And, you know, correlate that with the idea that these portals are becoming more active, there's a lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah, there certainly seems to be something in the works, something changing. And it may even be, part of me thinks it's kind of like the global warming thing in a way. It's like part of me thinks there's probably like a natural thing going on, and it's also fueled a lot, I think, by man. You know, I think the internet really has changed and technology has sort of changed the brains of people in a way.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely believe that. And, you know, again, that goes back to this concept we touched on a little bit earlier, and that's this idea of co-creating experiences. You know, when we look at the paranormal, it really has become a part of pop culture now. And, you know, there's so many shows on television. There's so much interest that's out there. And that's sort of a two-edged sword, you know, because on the one hand, it makes people more open and more willing to share things that they've experienced. But, you know, at the same time, what are some of the, you know, there's a portion of these things that are possibly being created by the people who are experiencing them. And it's just a very different time. It's funny, I always say, you know, when I started investigating the paranormal, if I walked into a party and, you know, admitted that that's what I did, you know, everybody would find other places to go away from me, you know. Now if I walk into a party and say that they're lined up out the door because they've all got an experience to share, you know, or a story to tell.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So.
It's incredible how much it's changed, and you know, with any type of change you have to adjust to that. So, you know, there's a lot of people that will tell you an elaborate story, and it amounts to, you know, the wind probably blowing the shutters back and forth on their house. You know, you take the good with the bad.
My pet peeve is always to hear the long, elaborate story, and then they finish with, well, what do you think it was?
Right.
It's like, how the fuck did I know?
Well, and, you know, I tried to be very tactful with that, being, you know, speaking in public so much and, you know, and being sort of, you know, out there at this point. You know, people are always approaching me with things, and, you know, some of them, I tell you, Tim, it's really hard to grit your teeth. I had someone approach me with a stack of photographs at one point, and they were all orbs, of course, you know, and she proceeded to explain to me that, you know, here's one she took in, you know, Arizona, and it's Abraham Lincoln, and, you know, she had another one that's just, you know, all these, it was clearly raining outside, and it's all these orbs, and, you know, she was convinced that the faces of all the founding fathers were in that photograph. And, you know, it's really, you know, you just have to sort of direct people as best you can to say, okay, well, you know, this is interesting. You know, maybe you should look at this a different way and try some more experiments. And, you know, I don't like to discourage anyone who's interested in the paranormal, but my gosh, at least take your time and, you know, do some research and do some valid study. And, you know, it's sort of my pet peeve now with a lot of these people that have flung themselves into the, quote, ghost hunting field. And, you know, the foundation of their knowledge is that they've seen every episode of Ghost Adventures or something.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned, you know, Hans Holzer or, you know, Jacques Vallée or, you know, any of these people to them. They're like, well, who's that?
Exactly, yeah. It's yeah, it's too bad. This you touched on it too. There's nothing wrong with specialization, but you should know about what's going on. You know, if you talk to a baseball reporter, they can at least tell you who won the Super Bowl. But if you talk to you know, some of these ghost hunting people, they don't even know who Stan Friedman is.
Right.
It's like,
right.
That's no way to be.
Yeah, it's a shocking level of ignorance. You know, at least educate your. I mean, come on, the term paranormal. You know, it. The definition is what's beyond the norm. You know, so all of these things technically fall within that. And, you know, you don't have to, you know, voraciously pursue all of them, but my gosh, at least have a little bit of foundation knowledge. And too, you know, so you can direct people. I mean, if you want to be a ghost hunter, that's fine. But if you have someone come to you with a UFO report, know where to direct them and, you know how to get them some, you know, don't shut them down.
Yeah. Now, I see here you've done some work with crystal skulls. Tell me a little bit about that.
I have. I became very intrigued by the crystal skulls back in the 70s. And, you know, on one of my trips to South America, I was down there pursuing, trying to find some teachers and get some, you know, shamanic instruction from some of the traditions down there. And also, of course, looking for other, you know, unusual stories and so forth, and ended up in this small town, and didn't speak a whole lot of Spanish, but constantly had these people, you know, coming to me, and, you know, of course, they guaranteed to show me, you know, such and such a secret for, you know, a certain amount of money, and, you know, was getting pretty frustrated, and finally had this friend of mine approach me and say, you know, there's this gentleman I think you should meet, you know, and he's an elder, and I ended up meeting this fellow and sat by this fire and talked with him late into the night with a translator who's an elder. And he, you know, just had this whole rich tradition that he had been taught from his family, different types of healing and ways of using energy and so forth. And, you know, he started referencing this source that he had that sort of spoke to him and gave him a lot of information. And, you know, this is late into the night. I'm getting very intrigued by this. And he finally asked me, he says, you know, do you want to see this? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. He's got this old burlap bag, you know, and he reaches into this burlap bag and out comes this huge crystal skull. And I you know, my jaw dropped and I was like, oh my God, you know what? You're kidding. And, you know, he gives me this thing and, you know, I sat there with it, and it was just amazing. It was an amazing experience. And, you know, I thought, wow, this is just incredible. And I, you know, people always ask me if it was an ancient crystal skull or not. I tell you the truth, I don't know. You know, it had been passed down through his family for as long as he could remember. So, you know, I don't really know when it was created. And, you know, quite frankly, that wasn't as relevant at the time, because it was a rich part of their tradition, and the way they were able to utilize it was very fascinating. And, you know, since then, you know, over the years, I was able to see a lot of the well-known skulls, you know, the Mitchell Hedges and Shana Ra and Nocerino skull and so forth. And it's very intriguing. I am a believer that some of these things are ancient and just unexplainable. And there's a lot of controversy about some of the skulls, you know, like the Mitchell Hedges skull and so forth. But, you know, it's there's no denying that people have had some pretty incredible experiences with some of these skulls. And there's a big question as to how they were created and, you know, how and where and possibly why. But, you know, to me, I think that the link is that they hold information. You know, some people scoff at that idea, but if you stop and think again and you look at technology, you know, our technology basically runs on crystals. You know, a tiny little crystal can hold an incredible amount of information, and that's because, you know, we know how to utilize a little tiny crystal. Well, what if we knew how to utilize something the size of a skull? Imagine the vast amount of information that could be held there. It's an incredible thought.
Interesting. Well, there are those types of psychics that can touch things and get the whole background on things like that. It'd be interesting to get a crystal skull into the hands of one of those people and see if they could access the information.
Yeah, and there have been some people, that's psychometry, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
There have been some people that have used that on some of the skulls. I know someone who attempted that with Max, who is one of the well-known crystal skulls that actually tours, you know, the person who has Max, a woman named Joanne Parts, takes him around the country and lets people, you know, view it and, you know, sit and touch it and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I know that a couple of people who are adept at psychometry have, you know, tried that with Max and get an incredible amount of information and visions from the experience.
Huh. Beyond that, you say people have interesting experiences with these things. What exactly are these experiences?
Well, you know, there are people who have reported that they've been healed from touching some of these skulls that they've gotten. And, of course, you hear things that are border more into the whole idea of psychic phenomena. You know, people will report that they've viewed their past lives or received information and so forth. What's intriguing to me is the people that have touched some of these skulls and had some kind of profound change in their life as a result, whether it's, you know, receiving some type of personal information that, you know, helped them change their direction or cause things to come into their lives, or, as I said, people that have experienced some type of healing on some level, whether it was physical or emotional, from touching these skulls. Now, you know, that could be, we really don't understand why that's occurring. You know, is it something inherent within the skull, or is it, you know, the power of our own minds holding that belief when we have this experience? That could be debated all day, and the truth is, you know, maybe that's not that important because people are having these experiences.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we've never done a show on crystal skulls before, so this is interesting. I've never really even looked into it too much.
Yeah, it's an incredible topic. It absolutely is. And you start to look at the history of some of the individual skulls, and it's, you know, it's very compelling.
They get kind of a bad rap because they've been tied to that Indiana Jones movie. They kind of had a little peak of 15 minutes of fame, if you will. ended up turning on them.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the skeptics are all jumping up and down and say, you know, no, they're modern creations, blah, 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 and, you know, the truth is now with modern technology, we can, of course, create these things fairly easily. I mean, you can buy modern crystal skulls that, you know, are very stunning, and look authentic. But when you're talking about skulls that surfaced, you know, in the 40s or whatever, then that's a bit more intriguing to look at and ponder, you know, how were these things created? And, you know, certainly meeting someone who's carried one within the family for generations, there are a lot of questions there.
Now, I see you also have a book coming out down the line called Strange Intruders. What's this all about?
That one will be out in probably a couple of months. It is it's looking at several different types of beings that seem to be making their presence a bit more known. So it has a chapter on the djinn, which has been, you know, a very popular topic in the last few years. It will cover the Slender Man, which we touched on briefly earlier today. It will have a chapter on black-eyed beings, just with some of the updated accounts that have come to me since the Black-Eyed Children book was published. Up in your neck of the woods, there'll be a chapter on Pugwedgies.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And a few other things. There's a chapter in there on the Grinning Man. Just covering some of these beings that haven't gotten quite as much attention, that are very intriguing and that have, you know, seemed to become more of a force in modern times.
Well, tell me about the Grinning Man, because I've never heard of this character before.
Well, the Grinning Man was chronicled by John Keel initially.
Okay.
And he was initially encountered by two boys during a UFO flap, and he was a very tall figure in a shiny suit with a large belt who had this incredibly large grin on his face, like, you know, unnaturally large. It's funny because it makes you think of like the Joker from Batman or something. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And this character has shown up in different forms over the years. Other people have seen him in different attire, and a lot of indications are that he's some type of precursor to strange events that are about to happen, or possibly an omen of things to come. And there's not really much of an explanation for what he is. He's shown up all over the place. And it's just, you know, it's a real enigma.
Weird. Now, the book's probably already finished, but I was going to suggest you check out Phantom Clowns. That's something.
Oh, I know about Phantom Clowns, yeah.
Talk about
creepy
stuff. I
have a bit
of
material on them, but I'm wrapping the book up now, and I'm kind of playing with a couple of other chapters that may go in it before it goes to press. So we'll see.
Now you reminded me here. You said black-eyed beings. You do mention in the book. It's not just children. There's also a few instances of black-eyed adults, if you will, right?
There are some, and a lot of those. You look at the cases, and they just seem to border more into possibly being a hoax or something else was going on. But there are some intriguing accounts that have shown up of adults with solid black eyes that seem to fall into that category, these black-eyed kids. Now, they don't tend to approach people in the same way with request to come inside, but they do approach people with strange questions, and they also seem to be a bit more aggressive, which is a little bit disturbing, I think. And there have been some very odd encounters with some of these black-eyed adults. There also have been a lot of cases that have come to me, and this will be covered in the book some too, of people witnessing someone's eyes change color while they're looking at them, from whether it's blue or brown or whatever to solid black very suddenly. And just as suddenly that solid black color going away.
Weird. Does the person change?
Very weird.
Does like the person know that it's happening to them, or is it, how does that sort of unfold?
Well, what tends to happen is that the person whose eyes changed, they almost react as if, uh-oh, I slipped up.
Huh.
So, what ensues is very odd. Afterwards, they'll try to convince the people that, well, nothing happened, just sit right here, let's talk about it, or, things like that. And it's very weird. It's very weird.
And they don't know these people necessarily. These aren't like your neighbor or whatever, right?
Well, no. Now, some of these cases are situations where, the person has known this individual for some time.
Oh, weird.
On a casual basis, and all of a sudden something strange has happened in this encounter where the eyes go solid black. And, it's very disturbing to the person who witnesses it. And, as I said, the aftermath turns out to be very odd. So, I don't know exactly what's going on there. A lot of these people say this, a lot of people who encounter this type of thing say this person must have been some type of shapeshifter, or they were something evil, or, this is very disturbing. Now, this is a fairly new type of phenomena, it seems to me. It's intriguing, at the least. A lot of people think that these are beings that have been here in our society for a long time, and something just suddenly made them slip up and maybe reveal who or maybe what they really are.
Weird. See, because as I discount the black-eyed kids being hybrids, I feel like that sounds like a whole different thing. Maybe those are hybrids.
Yeah, it does feel like a whole different thing to me. And, we could examine that in a lot of different ways. There just aren't enough cases yet. Well, I've received probably a few dozen of these cases so far.
Oh, weird.
And this is just a result of the book coming out. And, it's people will write me and say, hey, this is not a black-eyed kid, but this is what happened to me. And it'll be one of these stories. And far too many to ignore at this point.
So weird and new that it doesn't even have a name yet.
Exactly. Exactly.
I guess eye shifters.
Yeah.
Weird. Well, I want to know more about that, so keep me posted. Beyond Strange Intruders, what else do you have work? What else are you working on? It sounds like now you've kind of, I warn you now, I don't want you to get typecast as the black-eyed kid guy, but I'm afraid you may end up being haunted by the black-eyed kid forever.
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not. I've got a few other books that are in the works. I have actually one on tulpas that I had started, and it's just such a huge project that it's probably going to be late this year before that one makes it out. There's a couple of video projects in the works. I just appeared in Watchers number 5, which is a DVD series put out by L.A. Marzulli. And that was an interview about the black-eyed children, but they also did a recreation of one of the encounters within that. So it's the Texas encounter. the guy on the Texas back road who encountered one, and they did a great job. It came out. It's very creepy. So that's already out. As I said, I've got a book on tulpas coming out, and a couple of other books that are in the work. I tend to often multitask and write multiple things at the same time until I get, you know, close on something and then sort of lock it down and finish it. So plan is for there to be several books out this year. And I write a lot of articles. I try to keep my blog fairly active. I write for Intrepid magazine and a couple of other things that come out, internet-based publications. So I stay pretty busy.
Nice, nice. And, of course, folks can find out all about your stuff at twocrowsparanormal.blogspot, and if they want to pick up the book, they got to go to leprechaunpress.com to get it.
That's
right?
Correct. That's correct. It is not on Amazon. It's only at Leprechaun Press.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Who wants Amazon? They get their hand in your pocket the whole time. So
that's right.
Now, do you have a favorite kid or anything? But do you have a favorite story that you think is like, you know, your favorite or the most creepy or the funniest, or, you know, to sort of send people off on the final note? Do you have one that stands out that we haven't talked about yet?
You know, the two that really have always stood out for me was the account that I gave you earlier about the gentleman with the pit bull. Mm-hmm. And the other one is actually the one they recreated in Watchers. Now, people ask me, you know, often what I think the creepiest story is. For me, it's this encounter in Texas, and the reason is that I spent a lot of time in the field investigating and you know, different cases and traveling, and I love to drive. So, you know, it's nothing for me to drive, you know, several states away. I've driven coast to coast. So when I sat down with this guy to get his account, you know, I'm thinking, my God, this is me. You know, because this guy, this guy's in the military, however, but he loves to drive. And, you know, he's telling me his story and saying, you know, I just love to drive. I love to drive late at night. And I'm thinking, yeah, so do I. You know, his story was that he was on leave. He was visiting family in Texas. He has other family members in West Texas, and he's out in eastern half of Texas. And as we know, it's a very big state. So he decides to go visit these other family members in West Texas, and then he's going to drive overnight. So, you know, he gets his truck ready, and he loads up on, you know, a thermos of coffee, and he takes off, and he's driving these Texas back roads. He's not on the main interstate. He's driving these Texas back roads in the middle of the night. He's in the middle of nowhere. He pulls off to relieve himself because he's had so much coffee. Parks his truck on the side of the road, takes a few paces off the road, you know, and takes care of his business. He's kind of standing there looking up at the stars for a moment, comes back to his truck, walks around the front, reaches for the door, and all of a sudden he realizes there's this kid standing there by his truck. And, you know, he reacts like anybody would. He says, geez, kid, you scared the hell out of me. And, you know, what are you doing down here? And this kid, very cold, says, I want to go for a ride.
And, God.
You know, this guy is, he, like any of us would do, you know, he's looking around, he doesn't see a car anywhere, he's looking off in the distance, there's not even any lights from houses. This kid is insisting that, have me get in your truck, we'll go for a short ride. And this guy's really freaking out, you know, he tries to climb into the cab without turning his back on this kid, which is very difficult. He, you know, gets in, and, you know, this kid is staring in the window at him. He just floors it. You know, he takes off down the road, and he gets a couple of miles away, and he suddenly puts the brakes on. He's thinking, geez, you know, what am I doing? I shouldn't be reacting like this. Maybe this kid needs help, you know. Does a U-turn in the middle of the road, goes back to the spot. This kid's nowhere to be seen anywhere. You know, he's got a flashlight out. He's looking all around. Now he's really creeped out and turns back around, drives to his destination without stopping. And, you know, gets to his relative's house, and he said he just sat down and just started watching nonsense on television. You know, he just needed to disconnect from that and be, you know, as far away from it as he could. And this guy was so shaken up by this encounter, when he left, went back the same route. He did so during the daytime, so that he could find the spot again and search the area to see if there were any houses anywhere nearby. And, you know, the closest house he found was, you know, quite a distance. So he's very disturbed by an encounter. It was, it unnerved him to the point that he says he won't drive at night anymore. So, you know, that one to me was kind of disturbing because, like I said, I'm that guy. I love to drive late at night. And, you know, I tell you, it crosses my mind when I'm driving late at night now on some back road.
Yeah, it's like these things, they catch, they like, I think you made the point earlier. It seems to always, they wait for the right opportunity and they catch these people unaware.
Absolutely.
Right when you least expect it.
Yeah.
This little black-eyed kid shows up and changes your whole world.
That's right.
Oh, my God. Well, we've gone way over the 2 hours, and I'm stunned by how fast this conversation has gone by. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. We definitely want to keep talking to you, you know, in the weeks and months and years to come as this story unfolds. I hope that we'll learn more about these things. I really do, because they're so intriguing. But I'm flummoxed, as I said earlier. This is a mind-boggling topic, and mind-bending in a lot of ways. And I think we'll leave not just me, but the listeners sort of pondering this for quite some time afterwards. I'm sure you've sort of ruminated on this for quite some time.
Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, to tell you the truth, I mean, as you've heard, I've kind of moved on to researching other things, but, you know, this is something that's always going to be intriguing just because of its complexity and, you know, the number of questions. It seems to be one of those things that the more information there is, the more questions there are. So it's quite an enigma.
Yeah, but it's great. I'll be honest, it's awesome.
It's very fascinating.
Yeah, I really do find the topic to be tremendous. So I'm psyched that we had such a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Coming soon, Strange Intruders. You said, what, a couple months, maybe 2-3 months?
Yep.
Hopefully just in time for the summer so folks can have some creepy campfire reading, right?
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to plug that is coming up, any appearances or anything like that you think should be mentioned?
I've got a lot of stuff that's not locked down yet, but I will be at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis. That is just an incredible event. This will be the second year. It was a pleasure to be there last year. I'll be back again this year along with a host of just amazing speakers, Giorgio Tsoukalos, L.A. Marzulli, just a whole wide range. You can find that. Just Google Paradigm Symposium or go to intrepidmag.com. There's a link for it there. I'll be in Texas for a paranormal convention in October, and a whole wide range of other things. Best way to keep up with me is to check my blog, which you mentioned is twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. There is a badge on there for Facebook. People are welcome to friend me. I've got a Twitter feed and all that jazz.
Nice.
And the book can be found at leprechaunpress.com.
Sounds good. Well, David, I can't thank you enough. As I said, the time has flown by here, and it's been a thoroughly enjoyable conversation. And I really, like I said, can't thank you enough. It's been great. So thanks for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you again in the future.
It's been a pleasure, Tim. Thanks.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to David Weatherly for coming on the show and giving us so much time. You can find out more from him at twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. Pretty simple, all one word, two, crowsparanormal.blogspot.com. And if you want to pick up a copy of The Black-Eyed Children, head on over to leprechaunpress.com and order it there. Trust me, folks, you definitely want to check this book out. It is tremendous. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, but we are kind of over the limits of how long I would like to wait between episodes, so we're going to skip listener feedback here this week. I have a big list of emails to read, which I will tackle in future editions of the program, but I want to get this episode out to folks as soon as possible. So we're going to skip listener feedback here this week on the program. That said, let me give you the means to contact me if you'd like to be a part of future installments of listener feedback or if you just want to share your thoughts on the program. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com
or head on over to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, ofamerica.com, and click the contact button. And if you want something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. You can also find that by clicking the forum button at Binall of America. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. It is theusofe.com, where you can find conversations on not just the world of the esoteric, but also pop culture and sports as well. Additionally, I am also on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and that will bring up my profiles on those social network sites. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, let's plug the official BOA Facebook page, which you can find by punching in simply Binall of America on Facebook. As of right this moment, we have 951 likes, so we are a mere 49 away from the illustrious and elusive 1,000 likes. Head on over there to find updates on what's going on at Binall of America, future episode information, and links to stuff that relates to the program and media appearances by yours truly. Binall of America on Facebook. Check it out. Up next, please allow me to take a moment to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru Jeremy Boston. Behind the scenes at Binall of America, Ray Weigel is hard at work on BOA 3.0. I have gotten a glimpse of the early stages of this new website, and it is really something to behold, and I cannot wait to unleash it on the BOA listeners and the Binall of America visitors. That said, we are definitely quite a ways away from the grand unveiling. So, as of right now, all I can say is stay tuned, my friends. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Binall of America franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. There are two ways to do so. You can head on over to Binall of America and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation, there is also a way to do that. You can simply write to Tim Binall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address at Binall of America right under the PayPal button. As always, I should note that no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Binall of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we are going to try something a little bit ambitious for you, my friends, because next week we are scheduled to roll out our annual BOA Audio Baseball Special, where we talk about baseball with some previous BOA guests. It is the much maligned annual tradition here on the program, and since that is the case, and since the vast majority of BOA Audio listeners do not tune in to the Baseball Special, I don't want to leave those folks out in the cold, so we're hoping to roll out two episodes for you next week. Not only the BOA Audio Baseball Special, but also a pure esoteric edition of the program featuring author Thomas Fusco talking about his groundbreaking theories as detailed in his book, Lifting the Cosmic Veil. Thomas believes he has unlocked the secret of much of the world of paranormalia, and he is going to detail that on the program. It is a fascinating conversation. It is really a remarkable theory, and one which will have you riveted, I am sure. I cannot give you much more of a detailed preview than that, because I have not sat down to edit the entire interview, but I do recall that it was quite the compelling conversation. So, hopefully, next week, you'll be listening to not only the BOA Audio Baseball Special for 2013, but also Thomas Fusco talking about lifting the cosmic veil next time on BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to David Weatherly for coming on the show. Be sure to check out the book, The Black-Eyed Children. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the folks who tune in to the very end of the show and spread the word about this creepy little esoteric podcast. Your enduring support is humbling and appreciated, my friends. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.